Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hi.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming as a hobby. And we're talking about a particular board game today because it's a regularly scheduled episode of our podcast, which means we choose one board game. We talk about how you play it. We talk about some strategies you can employ in the game. And we talk about the design of the game. So, Matthew, what are we going to talk about today?
So we are talking about Betrayal Legacy, but kind of like what we did for Charterstone, we are going to be talking about the first half of the game.
Right.
We have done five sessions plus the prologue, so six sessions.
Mm-hmm. Which is a little bit under half of the sessions.
Right. And so, yeah, so Betrayal Legacy, designed by, there's a bunch of people, Rob DeVoe, Noah Cohen, J.R. Honeycutt, Ryan Miller, Brian Neff, and Andrew Veen, published in 2018 by Avalon Hill. All and, right. Of course, it is a legacy implementation of Betrayal at House on the Hill.
Mm-hmm. Which we have done an episode on.
Yeah.
So just to give a short description about Betrayal Legacy. In Betrayal Legacy, players are the members of family lines that are curiously linked to a dark and mysterious house. Each session, players control a member from their family's history during different time periods, cooperatively exploring the house's various rooms, encountering events, and obtaining items. Throughout each session's players will also find omens, and once enough omens are found or some other event occurs, a haunt will begin. During the haunt, typically one player is designated the traitor, and the rest of the players are designated as heroes, and these two teams receive different rule books that explain how they win in a unique scenario. But it doesn't exactly explain everything that the other side knows. The scenarios often involve the appearance of monsters or other horror-themed anomalies, and when the victory condition of the haunt is met by either side, the game ends. Betrayal Legacy is played over 13 sessions, including a prologue session, and each session, new events, items, rooms, and omens are added to the game. So that is the basics of the gameplay of Betrayal Legacy. It's
right.
The gameplay is very similar. It's got the same sort of loop or structure that the original Betrayal game has, but it's a legacy game. So you start with a small number of components, and over the course of the game, you start to add more and more to the game. You add more components, and you start to unveil this greater narrative that is happening throughout the different sessions of the game.
Right. And with that in mind, I want to give a spoiler warning if you
now,
are.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to try my best not to give away too many spoilers, especially about the later sessions that we've played.
Right. Yeah.
And especially about the haunts involved. I mean, we might give away a little bit, but I think I'll probably just try to stick to more of the gist when it comes to gameplay specific, especially about the haunts.
Okay.
Maybe we do a section towards the end of the episode where we really get into the details and get real spoilery. Personally, I'm going to try to not give away spoilers for the first part of this episode.
Right. I will still give a general warning, like, if you care a lot about spoilers, we're probably going to inevitably end up spoiling even just small things. I know legacy games, you know, it depends on person to person how much you want to know going in. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, just heads up.
Now, to be fair, the way that this game is structured, usually there's only two or three potential haunts at the end of a given session. And so we've only experienced like a little less than half of the possibilities.
True. We don't even know everything that's in there yet.
Right.
Like, so, even from what we could have seen.
Yeah. I mean, just like in the original game, the room that you find the last omen on, or the room that you that the haunt is triggered in, will determine which scenario you play out for the haunt. And, you know, there's two or three different scenarios that you can possibly trigger. And we've only played half or less than half of them. So spoilers for us might not be spoilers for your session.
Right. Yeah. All right. So getting into the gameplay side.
Right. Let's get a little more specific. So every player has a character board, and each character board has the same four stats as in the first game. However, in the first game, you played as these six unique characters, or potential 12. Sorry, there were 12 unique characters in the first game on double-sided character boards. This game, there are five characters, and they're not really characters. They're just stats for your family bloodline.
Yeah.
And every session, you make up a new character that lives or that's a part of this family line. You give them a new name every time because each session happens decades after the previous session. And oftentimes your character will perish sometime during the haunt. So
though technically
there won't be a possibility for the repeats.
Well, I was going to say technically the rule book says that if your character does not die, you can bring them back.
Yeah, I'm just saying it, oftentimes they will.
Sure.
But if they don't, you know, there's a possibility. You have the option. There's no real gameplay ramifications whether or not it's a repeat character or a brand new character. It's mostly up to you flavor-wise.
Yeah.
So it's a cooperative game at first when you're all exploring this house. And by exploring the house, you have a speed stat, which determines how many spaces you can move, and generally each room takes up one space. And then every time you pass through a doorway that doesn't have another room on the other side, then you discover a new room.
Right.
And the way that this works in this game is there is a stack of room tiles, and each room has a potential floor, or I think in this game they're called zones. It has a potential zone that it can go into. And so you go through the pile of room tiles until you find one that goes in the same zone that you're exploring in, and the rest get put on the bottom of the pile in the same order that you shuffled through them. So right, discover a new room, you put it attached to the doorway that you just passed through. You have to, to your best ability, attach it to any other doors that it might connect to in other rooms. And then you place your character in there and you perform an action. I mean, usually the room will have certain icons on them, and the icons will tell you what kind of actions you need to take.
Right, yeah. So, if it has a like a bull's head or boar's head, not boar, ox head icon, then that means that you draw an item. You look at the item deck of cards, and those also have zones that they can appear in. And so you do similarly to the rooms, you keep going until you find one for the zone you're in, and you draw it, and you would put the item in front of you.
Mm-hmm. If it has this little like swirly symbol, that means you've encountered an event. So the events have zones. You go through the event deck until you find an event that is in your zone. At the top of the deck, you put the rest of the cards on the bottom of the deck that you shuffle through, and then you encounter that event, which usually involves it has some sort of a small encounter in it. It'll describe a scenario, and then you'll usually have to roll either a skill roll, or you'll have to just roll some number of dice to determine an outcome.
Right. You do whatever it tells you to do based on that outcome. And this can have any sort of effect on you or your character or the world or whatever. And then if it doesn't tell you where to put the event, you put it on the bottom of the event deck.
Right. And just to describe what a skill roll is, your character has four abilities, which are in this game, speed, might, sanity, and knowledge. So whenever you have to make a roll of any of those particular skill types, then you look at the number that you have for that ability and you roll that many dice. As a reminder, this game has special dice, which have two blank faces, two faces with one pip, and two faces with two pips. And each die, on average, will roll a one. Or any for any number of dice, the average roll is equal to the number of dice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see.
So
another thing that I wanted to explain right here.
We should probably go ahead and mention how the traits sort of are structured. So each family has a different starting trait for each trait, a different starting number. And then the rate that those decrease or increase when you take damage is different per family. Like when your character gets hurt. Oh, do you want to explain this?
Yeah, I was just going to say generally the starting traits are three or four.
Right.
And most families will have two traits at a four and one trait at, or two traits at a four and two traits at a three for their starting traits, except I think one has three threes and one four.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were saying about the progression and regression of those abilities. Right.
So when you gain a number of a trait, like gain two in speed or something, you don't actually add the number. You slide a tracker up your progression rate for that trait. So some families, they start at three, and then when they gain two, it would move them up two spaces to five. Sometimes gaining one from that starting position would put them at three again. It's mm-hmm. different from person to from family to family. Same thing with losing traits. If you lose something in a trait or you take damage and lower that trait from that, then it could lower that number, or it could just bring you closer to death.
Right. Each trait is more of an array of numbers on a slider, and gaining or losing means moving up a certain number of spaces rather than a certain number. And so the starting value, when taken into consideration of how the trait gains and loses points, will give you an idea of how good a trait is for any given person in the game. So yeah. For an example, my character or my family line has very good strength. And what that means is that I start at a four, which is above average. And all of my stats below the four are all fours. So if I take any damage to my might, I continue to have a four all the way up until I would die. There's also a large number of spaces below I'm at the critical value. By the way, when you take damage, you move the trait down, and then when it reaches the very bottom of one of your sliders, that's when you die. Right. And that can happen for any one of your traits. So I have a lot of health you can consider it health in my might trait, and it stays at a four all the way up until I die. In addition to that, if I were to gain anything in might, it would go up to five if I were to gain one, and it goes all the way up to eight. So it has a good progression, and it has a very favorable regression.
Right.
As opposed to my knowledge and sanity, both started at three, and even when I gain one knowledge or sanity, it stays at three.
Right. On the other hand, my family has good speed and good sanity to start with. I think both are at four and have decent progression going upwards. But my mm-hmm. might starts at three, and I think gaining one might will keep it at three. However, I do have a lot of room as well below that starting value, and it doesn't go down until I die. So it always stays at three if I take damage.
Right. So generally, each character has two good stats and two poor stats. The good stats will have good progression. One of them will usually have a better regression than the other. And then for their poor stats, it's a similar thing. They'll both have poor progression and generally poor regression. The only exception is that there's that one family line that has three threes and a single four. So they have, on average, worse stats than the other family lines. But all of their stats have a good progression, where if they gain one in that stat, it does actually go up one.
Right.
So we're playing in a group of four people, and we decided not to take that good progression but poor average starting value family line. Nobody took it in our play group, so we just have four different family lines that all have something they're good at and something they're poor at.
Yeah, it pretty well evens out, actually.
Yeah, speaking of evening out. In this game, you find items, and you'll also find omens, which act like items. And like we mentioned in our Betrayal at the House on the Hill episode from last year, you want to be cooperative with your teammates during the first part of the game.
Right, yeah.
If you find an item that would be better suited with another player, or if you have an excess of items and it would be... And another player is not finding many, so you should probably share some with them. It would be best if you did, because when you're helping another person after the haunt is revealed, only one of those people is revealed to be a traitor. So it's more than likely that when you're giving aid to another player, you're giving aid to somebody who will be cooperative with you at the end of the game.
Exactly, yeah.
If you're not cooperative with other people during the beginning of the game, and then it comes around to the haunt, and it's just whoever got the luckiest happened to be the haunt, the traitor, and then you're left with a couple of allies who are in a worse position than they would be if you had been helpful to them. You know, you want to avoid that kind of situation.
Right. Also, I mean, it's worth noting that as a legacy game, this game is much more about like the narrative and the experience of playing through it. And I think it just makes for a more enjoyable experience for everybody if you, you know, kind of evenly spread out that type of stuff and work together in general.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't feel bad when, you know, the person who I gave an item to is the traitor because it just adds to the story.
To accompany this thought, there are these rooms in the game that have the similar sort of theme where they will they have the potential to boost one of your stats by a point. And the way that these rooms work, they all work in the same way, just about where you go to that room and you perform an action involving one of your stats. If you roll a 3 or higher, then you lose your turn and nothing happens.
Well, you lose all moves.
Yeah, you lose all moves. You can do whatever else for your turn, but you can't move anymore. You're stuck there. If you roll a 3 or higher, and then otherwise nothing else happens. If you roll a 1 or 2, then you get to increase your stat by 1 point. And then if you roll a 0, then you take a point of damage in another stat. So these are rooms that if you have a poor stat, you have the potential to grow that stat a little bit. But if you have a very good stat in the one in that room that you would roll, you're probably not going to be able to grow it any further in that room. You have to have just like a slightly below, you have to have a below average stat to get use out of those rooms.
Yeah.
When those rooms appear and there's people in your group, maybe they've taken damage in those stats and they could stand to recover a little bit, or just maybe you have people in your group that have a slightly lower starting stat and it wouldn't be a bad thing if they were able to increase it just by one. Then it's good for them to go to that room. And while they're doing that, it's good for everyone else just to kind of take a turn to not do anything.
Right, yeah. This is, I think, a big point, is there is no timer on the game before the haunt starts. So take your time moving around, you know. It's okay to have a round around the table where nobody flips over rooms if you just want to get to a better position or look for items or not look for items, but like, or pass around items or, like you said, using these stat gain rooms.
Yeah, maybe you've been exploring a lot of rooms in the ground floor and you kind of want to go to the basement. Then, you know, while they're moving to the room to increase their stat, you can move towards the basement. But,
right,
you know, don't explore any new rooms.
Yeah, of course.
In early sessions of this game, the haunts can come on very quickly. So it's, you know, it's better just to take a turn to make sure everyone's performed preparatory actions before you start exploring rooms again.
Right, yeah. I would definitely, like, if you're going to do this concept, talk it over with your play group first.
Right.
But, you know, it makes sense when you think about it, so it's not too
hard to talk about. It's only fair to at least take one turn off, because, I mean, it could make a whole bunch of difference if that one turn wasn't taken off. Like, you'll catch multiple people probably in poor positions when the haunt starts. And that's not always very fun.
Right. I want to bring up one point about an item mechanic that we haven't discussed.
Okay.
So some items have a little shield, or like a dotted line where a shield could go on their card, kind of in the bottom side.
Mm-hmm.
And these are heirloom stickers and spaces. The idea is when you draw an item card, if you haven't made an item an heirloom this game, you can put your family's crest sticker on it, or like the heirloom sticker for your family. And that will give your family, so you, benefits when you have the item that only you get if you have that item. Otherwise, you know, if somebody else draws it, they get the normal benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And you also get to name it a little personalized thing. You could name it like one of your previous characters' names and it belongs to them or belonged to them. You know, it's an item you pass down.
Right. And it's an heirloom.
Yeah. Since you can do this once per game, I definitely recommend trying to do that if you can.
Yeah. You only get 9 of these stickers for performing this action. And up until now, it seems like yeah, you can only make one per turn, and I've only made one heirloom over six sessions of this game. So
it's okay not to do it, because like, you're not missing out on too much.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's a thing where like, if you get the opportunity, you might as well.
By the fourth session, if you've only done like one heirloom, then just do it every game, because we only have how many sessions left? Seven?
Yeah.
No. Eight sessions left, and I have eight stickers left. So if I'm not making an heirloom every game, then I'm just kind of wasting my time with those heirlooms.
Right. Stickers. Yeah. Oh, I want
to. I suggest just doing it any chance you get.
Yeah. One more thing I want to bring up in terms of gameplay, strategy, whatever, is that from my experience, the upper floors have the least amount of omen tiles.
Mm-hmm.
The outdoor, which is a new zone in Betrayal Legacy, and the basement, I think, have more than the other two zones.
Probably. I think it's less... it's not spread evenly. There is a higher concentration probably in the outdoor / basement zones.
Right.
But it's not by much, because there is a lot of overlap with cards that contain omen. So
sure.
I think it's safe to say that the upstairs probably has the least number of them, although we haven't actually gone through and checked. While we're playing this game, we're not really paying super. We're not going through everything and seeing what everything does, so we know what all we're about to encounter.
Every time
we add cards to the game says you can take a look at what those cards do that you just added, but we've ignored it because we kind of want to be surprised by it.
Yeah, the way it works for the cards, you'll either get them when you're like going into the next session, or there's like a special deck called the Purgatory deck, where you look for just a small number in the corner and you don't look at any other part of the card when you're like digging it out. And then the tiles, they're on like these punch out planks, and each plank has a letter, and then the game will tell you just like, put, you know, take out the tiles from plank A and put them in the stack.
They're numbers, the planks.
Oh, are they numbered. Okay. Sure, but yeah.
But it's pretty much just like you add plank one, and then second session you add planks two and three.
It's pretty straightforward.
Four and five, and then...
You rarely have to actually look at what's going to be added in, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, and just to describe a little bit about the legacy components, there is a legacy deck, which contains... It contains stopping points and pausing points that will tell you... it'll give you information about the next session, and information about how the haunt is triggered in the session you're playing. And then it also contains items and events that are guaranteed to be added to the decks, and omens that are guaranteed to be added to the decks every playthrough of this whole game.
Yeah.
The Purgatory deck are cards that you add to the game after a session that are dependent on the actions that were taken during the session. So whether the traitor or the heroes win, certain purgatory cards will be added to the playthrough,
and certain cards will be destroyed.
Yeah, and certain cards will be destroyed because they might like never show up after a certain point.
Right.
And then with the room tiles, usually a couple of them are added at the beginning of every session. But then we encountered a haunt recently that added a new room tile after we'd finished it, and destroyed another room tile from the game.
Yeah.
Right, it may have buried it, and there's a difference. There's destroying cards and pieces in this game means destroying them for good, like you'll never play with them again. Burying means that you keep them in the box, which I assume just means that...
Hold back.
You mean putting it in the tomb.
Yeah.
It means putting a card or a piece in the tomb means you keep it with the game. Likely, after you've defeated you've completed the campaign, you can still play the game, and those cards put in the tomb will come back.
Right.
Again.
Yeah, I was getting a little quick there because bury is a term used in a completely different context.
Right. In this game, it just means you tuck it under the deck when you bury something.
Yeah.
It should be mentioned that we glanced over it briefly, but there are some slight changes to the way that the house is set up in this game, and that is that there's a fourth zone, and that's the outdoors. So you can go out the front door in this game, which is pretty cool. and explore the grounds outside of the house, which include like graveyards and trees and forests and caves and stuff like that. And then also at the beginning of the game, the stairs will lead to the upper landing and the basement landing. It's just accessible at the beginning of the game.
Right. There's like a little
every time.
Like, yeah, where the upper stairs are next to it, there's little downstairs.
Yeah, there's a little tiny downstairs staircase.
Yeah.
So you don't have to find any access to the basement. And once you go there, you don't have to find any way out.
Yeah.
Let's see. We've discovered that the best way to avoid revealing the haunt is to search and stick to the area that has the most omens revealed in it already. Mm-hmm. It's probably not guaranteed because I think every area in the house probably has enough rooms, except for actually there was a session where we explored the whole upstairs.
Yeah.
And I don't think there was enough omens there. So maybe there aren't enough omens in every area to trigger the haunt in the usual way. So it's probably a safe bet to stick to one area as
right.
a group if you want to extend the pre-haunt phase. But that's not always necessary.
True, yeah.
The game is being played. You know, that the haunt doesn't always occur at the last possible moment.
Yeah, you can only get
one way.
You can only get so far by trying to one up the game's RNG there.
Yeah, I'd say the only reason you'd want to do something like that is if you like the first two rooms are omens.
Yeah.
And then you might say like, okay, that's too fast. Or, you know, the first however many rooms, if you get way too many omens too soon, then you might want to spend like just a round of turns where everyone explores the ground floor.
Yeah, get to experience it a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Attitude really makes this game. Meaning like when you encounter an event or you find an item or something, you kind of put on like a character, you know, maybe you put on like a grave, spooky voice and you read the,
I would just say like, you get what you put in. If you like take care of like role play or really get into character, like I said, you know, yeah, you will probably enjoy it more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I have to say is that obviously you should save your rerolls and your teleports with the deed.
Which, yeah, that's a whole mechanic.
Yeah, the deed is if you win a session, so if you're the person who triggers the victory condition for either side, you obtain this thing called the deed, which is an item that you can spend the next session to teleport anywhere into the house. So you should save that, and then you also will get access to rerolls at some point in the game. Save those until you absolutely need to use them.
Yeah.
So I think that's about it for gameplay.
Okay.
And I think that's also about it for a spoiler-free discussion. I think we've been pretty spoiler-free up until now.
That was surprising, yeah.
Yeah, so let's get into the design of the game, and maybe let's get a little more spoilery.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay. Rubbing my hands together. There's some fun
so
stuff
far,
here.
Yeah, this game's design is really good.
Top notch. Mm-hmm. Rob, you've done it again, and the whole team.
Really great legacy game.
Yeah, so one thing I love is that some parts of the game are foreshadowing / foreshadow things. So, for example, one thing we didn't mention is ghost stickers, that there are little circles in the corners of some of the tiles, and if a character dies anytime during the game on one of those tiles, then a ghost sticker is placed there. That's their ghost haunting that room, or that tile.
Mm-hmm.
And at the start of the game, in the prologue session, there's one tile that already has a ghost on it. But you don't know that it's a ghost until much later in the session.
Right.
So, like, the thing is, like, you know, you don't know what it is, and it's interesting and weird. But then when the context is gained by figuring out it's a ghost, it kind of unveils more world building. It's like this plot twist, sort of.
Right.
Right, yeah. It's, you know, it's like when a mystery is solved, but just adds more questions.
So what I have on this sort of theme or this aspect of the game is that this kind of thing is present in all legacy games because you start with very few components and parts of the game. And then you start adding new elements to the game as the sessions go on. And sometimes those elements are, you know, they're in plain sight. Like you can see you have a whole sheet of face down stickers that you got to peel away and add to the rule book. And there's, you know, boxes of stuff, but sometimes they're not foreseen, you know, they're tucked under the insert in the box or something.
Yeah.
So the legacy games have all these mysterious things that you add to the game, and this game with the mysterious pieces you add includes this sense of dread.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes it's a spooky thing. Like it has a horror theme to it, whatever you're adding to the game, or it's just weird and out of place. And it makes you kind of nervous for the implications. There's a huge one
that I can think of in this example.
But I just think that because of the tone of the game, it very successfully meshes with the legacy game aspect that you are adding these new mysterious things to the game. Now there are also these new mysterious spooky things. It really does something for a player in this game.
Right, yeah. I think one of the things I love about the legacy game concept is the player and the designer go into it knowing that they won't be shown everything immediately, and they mm-hmm. probably won't know everything the moment it's shown to them. And like, you know, you can have secrets and twists and reveals and stuff like that. And like you said, like there's stuff that's really confusing and doesn't have any apparent function, but because it's made to have such a huge like presence, you know, when you do it, you take, like, I guess one example I can probably give is on the back of the rule book, there's a clock
mm-hmm.
with 13 numbers and little check boxes under each number. Some things will tell you to check in those boxes. We don't know what it'll end up doing.
Yeah, and we don't know, and it's not the same kind of thing that's telling you to check the boxes. Like,
yeah,
like I think we've checked one box just from completing a haunt, but we've checked another box from ticking all the boxes on an event card.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So like this thing, we don't know what it does. We don't know what it means. But
yeah,
that's okay. It fits with the atmosphere of like this horror nonsense.
Yeah, you're talking about a mysterious sense of dread. A ticking clock with 13 numbers is a perfect sort of metaphor for that. But yeah, it's a figurative thing, and it's a literal thing in this game.
Yeah. I love one thing we noticed. I don't think we noticed this the first time we could have seen it, but some of the text boxes in the game, mainly in like the Bleak Journal, which has a lot of flavor text, some of them have like this like chicken scratch sort of etched out words below them that are very faint, kind of hard to make out, but are like ramblings and ravings of who knows what.
Yeah, there, it seems to be that there's this character in the game that is maybe the source of all of the strange things that happens in this game, or
feeds
or
just off of
maybe
it.
The first product of it, or yeah, maybe they feed off, maybe they're drawn to it. But there's this entity that we don't know what it is, and it's leaving these little notes in as like little journal entries or missives.
Yeah. In
different parts of the rule. I mean, there's some on the cards, there's some on the rule book, but they're mostly in this Bleak Journal. By the way, the Bleak Journal is a really cool addition to this game, where the original game has the rule book. It has the Trader's Tome, and it has Secrets of Survival. Those two being the rule books that contain all the haunt information for both sides. But this game adds the Bleak Journal, which is a series of entries that you are called to read at various points of the game. And sometimes an entry will just be a little bit of flavor to add to the situation.
Yeah.
Other times it will carry along with it some sort of reward or penalty or in-game action. Or change to the game.
Right, yeah. I think this is something that Charterstone also had, is like a way to convey like writing, just like text, narrative type of stuff
mm-hmm.
that's not in a game component. But this does also have game elements to it, and it's at the point where it feels like it can contain anything.
Yeah.
We've had, you know, stats change. We've had cards added to the decks through this. Bunch of stuff happens.
Right. Lately, okay. Let's see. Heavy. So I have it written heavy story building between sessions. It's better if you have played the original Betrayal game, because it feels like there's a lot of similar like rooms and items and game pieces in this game.
Yeah, there's like callbacks.
Yeah, and although they're not really callbacks, they're more like origin stories.
Yeah.
Like, we played a session recently, and because of the outcome of the haunt, the collapsed room was born. And the collapsed room is a room in the original Betrayal game. The one in this game is slightly different mechanically, but it's essentially the same room. And it only appeared because we did something in a haunt.
Oh yeah, that was super cool. I loved just seeing how it came to be, and it wasn't even like, I don't know, I thought it was just like a neat, like, oh, that's cool, or like, huh, so that's where that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and I think what was also neat about it is it showed that, like, we as a play group had actions that impacted the future of the game, though, like, our actions had consequences.
Right.
But I think, so this is a problem I had with Pandemic Legacy, was that that game had actions that had consequences that felt too important. But in Betrayal, like, this consequence was just adding a room. So even though the collapse room can be kind of annoying, I think it was bearable.
Mm-hmm. It can also be kind of useful.
Right, yeah. It actually has utility here. But I guess in that way, it's more of like you get a treat for playing out the game.
I mean, I also like, so the way that this game works with haunts is when a haunt starts, you will uncover a new omen, and the game will tell you what to name the omen. And right. And the name of the omen is determined by which haunt you're going to play. But it doesn't have any mechanical effect. But I really like that. So after you find the omen and you give it the name, and then you play through the haunt associated with that omen, in the next session, you will find all these omens that have caused these different haunts in previous games. And so there's just that little extra bit of history with each omen.
Yeah.
You know, when you're playing Betrayal, the original Betrayal, and you find just like a girl or a madman or a dog or whatever, it just feels like, how is this really an omen?
Like, yeah, it feels like another item.
Maybe the girl seems like an omen, but yeah, some of the omens just feel like items. They don't really feel like omens. But now, you know, you find the doll, and the doll just in mechanically in this game, it counts as a ghost in addition to the other ghosts that are in the room that you're inside of. But in addition to that, we know as the play group, like, oh yeah, remember the doll haunt? Remember when we found the doll the first time and it did that crazy haunt that we had to play through, and then it created the collapse room? Spoiler.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know that. And so, I don't know, that leads to just some interesting, just something you think about as you're playing through the game and you're finding these omens again.
It's also a really cool bit where, like, you know, when the omen first appears, you kind of connect it to the haunt as being a problem. But then when you go back and you have it under your wing, you know, you have it under your, you know, in your inventory in a future session, it feels like you've conquered it and, like, gained control of it. Like, yeah, you have overcome the monster and become the monster.
Especially even, like, the first omen. It's just when you find the first omen that you find in the game, when you find it in later sessions, you're just like, man, we've come a long way since this one.
Oh, yeah.
Now I get to play with it. Like, it's just another item. It's kind of cool. Yeah.
It's a friend.
Going kind of back to the mechanical design, normally winning a session has a very big impact on future games.
Mm-hmm.
In a legacy game, but in this one, at least, especially in competitive ones, like when we played Charterstone, winning a session was pretty important. It seems like in this game, winning a session doesn't have a very big impact on the end of the game. If it does, we haven't discovered why. We just know that you get the deed in the next session, and that's it.
So far,
which I prefer.
Yeah, so far it feels like winning the game doesn't have a personal benefit. It just adds a different path to the story, which is more communal.
Right. It's almost entirely narrative.
Yeah.
The reasons to play through the various sessions of this game, which I think is a perfectly legitimate reason to want to play the game.
Especially a legacy game.
Yeah. I mean, a legacy game, you know, it should have a narrative. And in a game where the narrative is the main focus of playing through the whole legacy campaign, that almost gives me more reason to play through it than if, like, at the end of the campaign, one of us is declared the winner.
Just as an aside, I don't think every legacy game needs a narrative, but it is something you can do in a legacy game you can't do in a regular board game. And Betrayal is definitely an example where the narrative is the focus.
Mm-hmm. I like it personally. Right.
So speaking of legacy games, I want to talk about the very first session, the prologue, and how it can't be done any other way.
This will have spoilers.
Big spoiler for the very first prologue session.
Prologue. So this is a huge spoiler. I don't know, 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
4 minutes.
No, longer. Six.
Oh, 6 minutes. Okay. I'll start a stopwatch. All right.
Sure. So in the very prologue session, when the first haunt happens, the game says one of you is a witch. Everybody gets a card that's like a scratch-off card, and it will contain whether or not you are a witch or a civilian. And you are instructed to hunt down the witch and try to figure out who's the witch or not. And but, you know, you don't want to get yourself hunted. It's like a Salem witch trial sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, when you die, you don't reveal your card, or do you? No, you do.
You do reveal your card.
Right.
And if you were the witch, then the person who killed you wins. If you weren't the witch, then play continues until, you know, there's one person standing or the witch dies.
And the big spoiler is that nobody was the witch. The game hid that from you. It lied to you.
Right.
And this is great because, for one thing, it puts the players in the mind of the characters that there is a witch. I have to find them. I have to kill them. And that even though they're like, you don't know that there's no witch, the characters don't know there is no witch, you have the same motivation to kill the witch that the characters do. And the outcome is equally devastating, I guess, to realize that it was all for naught and that you were betrayed. Betrayal.
But betrayed by the very house itself.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you are betrayed by the game the same way the characters are betrayed by the house in this session.
I didn't really feel betrayed or frustrated. Sure. It ended up being me and our dad as the last two people standing. And when it came down to us, I think my dad said something that was like, well, I guess I know who the witch is. And at the same time, I was like, okay, well, if it's not me, then it's definitely him. But after he said that, I was like, oh, I think I know who the witch is. It's none of us.
Yeah.
But he still killed me anyways. And then, it turned out nobody was the witch. And we're playing with four players. There's a maximum of five. We even checked the fifth card to see if there was a fifth player, if there would have been a witch. And no, there wouldn't have been. Doesn't matter how many players you're playing with, nobody would have been the witch.
And because the game is meant to be played through once, and you don't see all the components and what they have ahead of time, and they have this like destructible element on the card, it's able to have that reveal and that twist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something that would be a lot harder to do without that conceit. And since like nobody had to make sure that there was, you know, only the civilian cards, and, you know, like the game was expected to do all the setup for you, which is why it could betray you.
Right. I found it clever and kind of funny when I figured out that there weren't going to be any witches. I don't know. I liked it. It was just, it set the tone for the game, even though since then we haven't encountered, you know, a similar situation where, we were put in, a situation where there was no betrayer. We haven't really been lied to since then by the game. It's almost kind of making me complacent for that kind of a thing to be a part of the game.
I'm expecting like a wake-up call, honestly.
Gonna happen eventually,
but that paranoia is the whole point, I guess.
Right So it's only been 3.5 minutes.
Okay, we can also talk about another huge spoiler.
Sure, here's another huge spoiler for the remainder of the so you find this at the end of what, the third or fourth session? I think it's the fourth session. You find the helm, the fourth
main session,
like, main session. fifth overall session, not counting the prologue.
Okay.
So the helm is, it's a very obscure thing when you find it. There's not a lot of information to it. The game just forces you to respect it.
Yeah, it has in rule text, respect it. Don't put anything on top of it when it's taken out of the box. When you take it out of the box, only touch the sides and say the magic words as you're doing so.
Right, and you have to come up with magic words for when you manipulate the helm or when you're taking it out of the box and putting it back away.
Right, and there's like all these runes and markings, and none of it's explained immediately, except for that it lets you reroll if you place your crest on it.
Well, it doesn't even explain that as as you find it. Sure. I think the next partway through the next session, it's explained that you can reroll the dice if you place your crest on the helm, and you can do that once per game.
Sure,
this is the reroll earlier. It's just cool that it added that thing partway through the game. This weird thing, it forces you to respect it. It also so it has these columns with these runes that you put your crest in, and for each column, it says that if you fill that column, if you're the last person to put your family crest in that column of slots and fill it up, then you read an entry in the Bleak Journal, and that's all it says. And so far, we've only filled one column, and filling that one column gave me a very big bonus.
Yeah, I like the fact that like you can't really tell anywhere near the start what it's going to be used for or what the outcome of doing anything with it is going to be. It makes it so you can never understand it fully, you know, which is a very fitting thing for a mystical, maybe demonic, maybe magical rune or like item.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how the game is forcing us to treat it. It's just this kind of like superstitious thing that we're supposed to respect but also fear. I mean, it doesn't tell you to fear it. It just says you have to respect it, and that just innately makes you fear it a little bit. Oh, yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, really, really great tone. That's 6 minutes. Okay, so people are proud. If people skipped us to skip spoilers, then they are returning now.
Welcome back to the fold. Welcome back. All right, I do want to talk about a problem I have really quick.
Okay.
Did you want to continue? Oh, well, anyway, so the rule book can use some work. Okay. Specifically, the Trader's Tome and Survival Guide.
Right. A big part about this game is that, you know, it doesn't have any hitches where it doesn't want there to be any hitches. Like, it's fine if there's situations where things are supposed to be a little bit vague, but in the situations where things need to be down pat, they need to be down pat. And we encountered a situation where that was not so.
Right. Yeah. So in the Trader's Tome and the Secrets of Survival, all the rules text is in like these colored boxes. And I think the like actual rule book explains that a bit better. But also in the Secrets of Survival in Trader's Tome, there is a couple other areas that have overviews of what you're going to be doing in the haunt. Mm-hmm. And the overviews are not rules text, but we didn't really fully understand that at first.
Right. I mean, they're written similarly to rules text. Like they have some vagueness to them, but it sounds like they can be interpreted as rules.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we played a haunt where the trader interpreted these sort of reminder texts as rules texts and performed a couple of actions that he shouldn't have performed, which were very much in his favor.
Yeah. And it's not his fault at all. It's just, the game was a little vague, and the fact that they use terminology that's bolded in both things, like important things are shown in bold, but they're shown in bold in both ways in pretty similar concepts, I guess. I don't know. It's like reading through it, if you're not very attentive and don't realize that it's like not in a box or not showing in action colon effect, you might not actually realize it's not rules text.
Right. Now, the way that the game tries to manage this is that it puts all of the important mechanical information about a haunt in these boxes. We keep mentioning these boxes. Yeah. They're these colored text boxes And they have specific functions. And if some rule is in those boxes, then that means that at any point during the haunt, if you perform an action in a box, then you have to the other team has the option to force you to read it out loud,
and then so you that have they to can read also understand.
Yeah, you have to read it out loud. The point of this is that first of all, it makes sure that you don't do anything that you're not supposed to do. You're not cheating
it keeps
anybody
you honest.
From either side. It keeps you honest. But it also gives both parties a chance to debate and interpret rules that they find a little bit confusing.
Right.
So if somebody is saying, I think this action lets me do this in the haunt, then everyone can read the rule to try and get a better understanding of the rule as a group and then come to a consensus. So the situation where we encountered was the thing that looked like a rule was not in a box. So therefore, it wasn't a rule. The person that thought it was a rule, they thought it was a rule, and we couldn't discuss it because it wasn't in a box.
Yeah.
We weren't. So it's kind of like the game says, if it's in a box, discuss it. If it's not in a box, don't discuss it. It's kind of like a way of reaching the conclusion you want the wrong direction. It's kind of like, taking the wrong path to the same conclusion.
Yeah.
What the game is trying to make you do. What the game should say is, it shouldn't say that, like, if you want to discuss something in a box, discuss it. It should say, like, don't take the things that aren't in a box as rules.
Right. It should better highlight that the things in the box are the rules that you follow and the important stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But
it was unfortunate that the rules were kind of put out that way, especially because it completely turned the tides of the haunt that we were playing, which, if we had actually interpreted the rules correctly, I think we had a very good chance of winning the haunt. And in the end, the traitor won.
Yeah, I'm not beat up about it.
I'm not either, especially in this game, because luckily winning a haunt doesn't have a huge impact on the campaign as a whole or on the next session.
Right. Yeah.
It's purely narrative. So we saw an ending to the haunt and an ending to the session that we wouldn't have seen if we'd played correctly. But if we'd played correctly, the outcome, either outcome would have been an interesting thing to witness.
Right. Yeah. But that's only happened once, like we said.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's just a small thing to keep in mind.
Right.
I think, like, that's always a huge part of game design and development, is writing concise rule books. It's way harder than you can ever imagine until you actually do it. That being said,
my only other gripe with this game is that that in the first few sessions, the haunts came on way too quickly.
Yeah.
Just because, like, in some games, you'll stack a pile in order to spread out, like, the end game conditions,
Yeah.
Like in, I don't know, pick any game, Legendary. In the Marvel Legendary game, you intersperse, a game where you intersperse certain cards.
Well, I was going to say Pandemic.
Pandemic, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the Outbreak cards, you intersperse them in sort of chunks throughout the deck of cards. So the game won't finish way too quickly. But in this game, it's kind of hard to even come up with a system that would function like that, just because going through in different zones of the game, you're shuffling through a lot of different cards in the deck. So, even if they are interspersed, there's a chance that you'll come across them anyways pretty quickly. It's just an unfortunate part of the game where, at least at the early stages, there were we came across the Omen cards very quickly in our play sessions, which ended really quickly, which, if there's a limited number of sessions, I kind of want any given session to last a little bit.
Right. This is sort of this is a common sort of sentiment that it seems like legacy game designers have, which is that a lot of them seem to believe that the first few sessions should be quick. So that, like, even though it can start out at a smaller scale, it can still ramp up quickly. And, I mean, take that what you will. I think this is just an example of that being, in full force.
I think
these are intentionally quick.
Now, the people will put in, like, designers will put in ways of mitigating the end game.
Yeah.
So that you can extend sessions. In Charterstone, I think we encountered that kind of a mechanic about a quarter of the way through the campaign, maybe a third of the way through the campaign. With us, we found it now nearly halfway through the campaign. We're a little close to halfway through the campaign.
The now most that we've recent,
found the first mitigating circumstance.
The most recent session, we've had a few abilities that let us like look at three tiles and
just put one ability on top.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
Right. Before that, one, the only way we had to mitigate it is by like
guessing and counting cards.
Exactly. Yeah, we didn't know what kind of rooms we were going to encounter. We could just say, like, if you go upstairs, there's not going to be so many omens. Or if you stick to one zone, there's not going to be so many omens because we're going to take out a couple to begin with. There'll be a lower density in that zone.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Though, so one thing, another thing that I like a lot about this game, switching gears, is that this game does a great job of making it worthwhile to do the fun thing. Mm-hmm. So like this comes up a lot in like video game design, is that like if you have all these cool options but only one of them is optimal and it's the boring one but it's efficient, people are going to use that because it works. Like, it's hard to expect the player to do the most fun thing for their own good all the time, especially in a game that has competitive elements. But this game does a great job of like telling you, you can do the cool thing, and there's a reason for it. So, my big example is the second haunt. Oh, this is technically a spoiler. At least for half the games. Right, yeah. The second haunt or so, maybe first or second haunt. I can't remember.
It was the second one.
Right, yeah. Is that I was, like, possessed by a spirit because I was a traitor, and there was a rule that was just, when you attack a hero, if you let out a bloody roar, you may attack again.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, like, there's no other instance of letting out a roar. So, you know, I just roared. I made that sound. And I attacked again. And it was so, like, just viscerally fun. But I might not have wanted to do that, honestly, unless it had that benefit. Because, like, I mean, I wouldn't have thought to make a roar to roleplay as that spirit. They're like, you know, but because they said, hey, you can do it, and here's a bonus for doing that, I was doing it every time.
Right.
And it definitely added to the atmosphere, in my opinion. It also had a cool moment when I first did it, and everybody was like, whoa, and asked me to read it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah. I think for a game that's narrative and atmospherically driven, it's a good thing that they put in this reward for adding to that atmosphere.
I don't have any other notes on the design of the game. Do you have any other notes?
Not that I can think of, honestly.
All right.
I think for the most part... Oh, actually, one thing I like is that it's pretty clear in terms of how actions work compared to Betrayal Original. In that, in Betrayal Legacy, it basically tells you this from the get-go, that there are actions that have a word, so like attack, drink, invoke, and you can only do one instance of that word per turn.
Right.
So I think that's pretty understandable, and it gets the point across, and it helps them balance like once per turn effects.
Yeah, it really helps like their rules on items in the last game.
Yeah, like, you can only attack using one weapon per game. Well, in this case, it's, you know, it's an attack action on the item card.
Yeah, really good quality of life cleanup to the rules of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, and any difference that this game has compared to the previous game just seems like a quality of life. The only major difference that I think kind of changes the game is that the haunt roll is slightly different. Whereas in the previous game, you rolled six dice every time and you tried to get higher than or equal to the number of omens that have been found. In this game, you roll a number of dice equal to the number of omens that have been found. Now, in the campaign, it, so far for the last few sessions, it's been that the haunt doesn't trigger until you roll five dice. So finding
five pips.
Yeah, or until you roll five pips or higher on the dice. So The first two omens are it's impossible to start the haunt. And then every omen thereafter makes it much more easier to start the haunt up until five, when it's average that you will start a haunt.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good. And in the earlier version of the game, you know, that meant that you could still start the haunt on the first omen. This game, it's impossible with those rules. However, I think at the end, when everything's said and done and we replay this game, then the rules just become you roll a number of dice equal to the number of omens. And if you roll fewer than the number of omens found, regardless, you start the haunt. So that gives it, you know,
honestly, I mean, I'm just going to wait until we get to that point to comment on that part.
So, it seems a little bit better.
Oh, this is a very minor thing, but they have a card that has reminder text for how monsters work. That's just really nice. And same for the differences between traitor and hero. Just having those heads up reminder cards, fantastic.
Right. Overall, good quality of life upgrades to the games, rules, and materials. All right. So if there's nothing else to be said, then that is our episode on Betrayal Legacy, part one. Sounds good.
Yeah.
If you like, you can go to our – you can follow us and like us and leave comments on any podcasting platform, as well as social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at BG Bros Cast. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we post all of our episodes and give them tags. So you can find our Betrayal episode just by finding the Betrayal tag and following it to the episode that we did on that game. If you're curious about the original one, you want to hear our in-depth thoughts on it. We also have a link to our TeePublic store page, which the URL is teepublic.com/user/bgbcast. That is where we sell our merch, and you can go there and pick up a t-shirt with our cool podcast logo. And then Matthew plugs.
Yeah. Also on our website, I am posting articles/blog posts, mainly about game design, but also just, you know, whatever I kind of want to write about. I currently have one up that's about games that I liked and played in 2018, and I am editing my next article, which will be about the recent Hitman games. I expect that in the upcoming week. And then I also stream every weekday on twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I play a couple different games, a lot of roguelites and fighting games and similar types of endless games, creative games, etc. And on there you can, you know, chat to me while I'm streaming. You can also find a link to a Discord server where you can chat to us through there and also other watchers.
All right. Very cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to our episode, and stay tuned for next week when we talk about I think next week, instead of doing a game, we'll be talking about a larger topic. Stay tuned later on for when we come back to Betrayal after we finish the campaign.
Yep. See you later.
All right. See ya.